Welcome, everybody. Thank you very, very much for coming. I've been asked to say immediately that tonight's hashtag is LSE Barricades. So I'm just doing that as instructed. My name's Judy Wiseman. I'm a professor of sociology here. And I myself have worked on technology and society and the effects of new technology on all sorts of things for many years. And so I'm really, really pleased to be here and kind of chairing this session because it's kind of right up my street, actually. Adam Greenfield is completing what everyone tells me has been an incredibly successful research fellowship here. He's been here sort of for a year as a research fellow in the Cities Program. And he's been thinking a lot about the effects of information technology on the city and life in the city. And in fact, he's a very well-known sort of critic of the kind of rhetoric and discourse around smart cities. And he's been giving sort of these kind of criticisms and talks for a very long time. And he tells me that he feels that it's incumbent upon him now to actually kind of give us a positive vision, not just be a sort of critic, but give us a positive vision of how kind of new technology can help produce a fairer city, a more responsible city, a more participatory city. And so I'm really looking forward to what this vision is. I'm going to be taking notes. So that's a fantastic thing. And we're also very, very lucky that Leo Hollis, who's sitting here, who's, I gather, Adam's editor at Verso, has agreed to come and be a respondent this evening. He himself has written a book recently called Cities Are Good For You, and I'm kind of curious in terms of who's going to be more critical and who's going to be more optimistic about the possibilities for smart cities and information tech cities and such like. So I'm looking forward to a very lively discussion. So we're going to have two presentations, and we're very much hoping that there'll be about half an hour for questions and discussions and a bit of a debate. So I'll now hand over to Adam, and thank you very much.
Thanks so much for that extremely warm introduction, Judy. It is lovely to be here at LSE, wrapping up my fellowship. The talk tonight is called A City Worth Fighting For, a very strident, aggressive title, my goodness. Subtitled Practices of the Minimum Viable Utopia 2. And we'll get into a little bit, I think, what we mean by that phraseology, the minimum viable utopia. As Judy mentioned, I've been here at LSE Cities as something called the Senior Urban Fellow. And, you know, I do feel like there's a whole bunch of stuff that's incumbent upon me. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, weighty title, like Senior Urban Fellow. My goodness, what does that imply? The expectation must be terribly high. So what I'm going to deliver tonight is an awful lot of material about the ways in which people are making use of the fabric of technologized urbanity that we now have access to in the contemporary urban environment. But it is not a particularly technical talk. And my inquiry for the past several months at LSE has not been a particularly technical inquiry. The terms of the fellowship that I'm here under specify that it is to be an inquiry in the humanities. And so instead of looking necessarily at the particularities of APIs or of connectivity protocols or of interfaces or of specifications for technical systems, we're going to be looking at, instead, urban intelligences, subjects, and subjectivities. How do we make use of the technologies that we have available to us, and what does that encounter make of us, both individually and collectively? And most particularly, what sorts of communities, collectivities arise out of our use of technologies in the context of the post-M15 movement, the post-Arab Spring movement, post-Occupy movement? My goal is to survey the terrain of technologized urbanism as it exists in our time, see if there's anything there that might support the development of the characteristics and the capacities and the competences that people have relied upon to help them navigate the complexities of urban life since time immemorial, the competences and the sense of savoir-faire that allows us to walk out into a city of 10 or 15 or 20 million people and turn it in some wise to our advantage, to not merely survive in that environment, but to make use of it and to thrive in it. My training, in some sense, is as a futurist. And one of the things that futurists are trained to do is amplify what we call weak signals. So instead of looking at things that are sort of settled questions that are, cut and dried examples, what I'm going to be sharing with you this evening are things that pop up around the horizon when you consider the world that might not at first glance seem to have a whole lot to do with each other. It's my job to connect the dots and hopefully convince you that there is a there, that there is something that is emerging in the confluence of these technologies and techno-social circumstances, and report back to you about what that might imply for our ability to know, make use of, and act in the city. As Judy mentioned, the very first thing I want to do, though, is dispense for all time with this very fatuous trope of the smart city. You've probably, if you've heard me before speaking, I don't need to say too very much about this, but this notion that we have of this gorgeous, glamorous, technologized envelope in which all of our needs will be anticipated and all of the things that we desire brought to us on a silver salver by the network techniques and systems that undergird everyday life in the smart city. It's a shock and a sham and a con job. The people who actually live in and make the smart city what it is, as a matter of fact, for the city, this city is Masdar in the United Arab Emirates, 79.6% of the population and a full 90% of the labor force of the place that we've just looked at actually lives in places like this. So, containers under the desert sun, uninsulated from the heat that falls upon it, behind a chain-linked razor-wire fence, patrolled by armed guards. The people who work on these places, of course, have their passports taken from them as soon as they arrive in the country. They have no more rights than an animal does. And so anytime you hear the word smart city, I want you to think about this being the reality of it. But we also know that, the other images that were peddled by the vendors of the smart city, these images of universal awareness and control, are more about policing space than anything else. And, I've had this image in my presentation for a while, sort of heavily militarized Rio de Janeiro police force, which is in fact deployed by this very elaborate and expensive IBM operations center that was built for the city of Rio de Janeiro. And events have kind of overtaken that image a little bit. I used to draw at great pains this connection between this sense of technologies of visibility that were consecrated to the needs of administration and the very, very heavy boot of militarized policing that falls upon the population. But I don't feel like I need to make that argument particularly hard anymore. I kind of feel like events have filled in the meantime and made that argument for me. So, I think we can kind of take it as read that I'm against the smart city. And if you really, really want to know why in more detail, if I haven't really spun this out yet, I do invite you to read the pamphlet that I wrote about it last year. Rather unsurprisingly called Against the Smart City. But it's not just this vision of technologized urbanity. It's a sense that I have that technology itself must have taken a wrong turn somewhere, that we're surrounded by and offered for sale alienation engines, devices that instead of actually connecting us to one another, alienate us from each other and ourselves. Technologies like this bracelet, the technologies of the quantified self, which sort of convey all of these very complex affairs about our relationship to our own bodies and the relationship of these bodies to one another and to the world as circumstances for individual management, as things that we have responsibility for managing ourselves rather than collectively. And of course, Google Glass, this technology that seeks to literally impose an interface between you and anybody else that you encounter. These technologies, far from being used to concretize the ambition toward universal awareness of all human knowledge that originally inspired the information technology community, are turned to ends of howling fatuity. This is an individual named Robert Scoble who was paid by Google to be one of their Google Glass explorers. Despite the fact that there's no earthly need for this technology, he wears it 24/7. He's released videos of himself in his shower wearing it. There's not really a thing for this technology to do, which is not to say that there might not be at some future time something interesting for it to do. But at present, the only things that anybody seems to be able to turn these devices towards are the needs of marketing, and particularly marketing to us things that we neither want nor need. And this is a beacon technology called Gimbal. And all of the scenarios that they've come up with to use this technology have to do with come try our new flavor of coffee, or welcome to the store, or thanks for coming in, stay tuned for other exciting offers. not merely is this invidiously about forcing commerce on people, but it's also about interceding in every possibility where there once was the potential for human contact. I mean, what is so terrible about being greeted and welcomed to a place by a human being that we would rather now have that mediated by our personal devices? I accuse these technologies of inducing in their users a certain lassitude. I mean, the question of moral vacuity is a real one, but it's not so much that that disturbs me as that these technologies are actively harmful to the development of skills necessary for meaningful participation in a layered, complex, and heterogeneous society, particularly our ability to tolerate and negotiate difference, particularly our ability to counter people who are dissimilar from us in any particular register. We've heard so much about the question of epistemic bubbles, of filter bubbles that surround us and within which we only need to consume media and opinions and information that is congenial to our existing predilections and orientations towards the world. That is absolutely real. And it's beginning to have an effect, even out on the sidewalk. It's becoming harder and harder for anybody to engage with the other people around them, even to the extent of reading the micro signals we're all making at all times that actually allow the sidewalk to work, that actually allow the flow on the sidewalk to run smoothly. So if I'm against all of this stuff, I think it's very fair to ask, what am I for? And I'd like to present to you four large bodies of evidence that support some tendencies that I'm very, very interested in. People making data, people making things, people making places, and people making networks. So the first one is people making data, no local. And a lot of this thought arises out of a seminar that we had here, a workshop, that was called Urban Data, from Fetish Object to Social Object, that we had at LLC Cities earlier on this year. It was an amazing opportunity to challenge the notion of big data and how particularly data is used to represent, understand, and act upon the very, very thick and braided circumstances of urban life. Big data is a technology of knowing. This is a fairly typical scenario in which data would be drawn out of the very fabric of the environment. This is Cisco's blueprint for smart and connected communities, and you can see things that you have to imagine the entire environment is embedded with sensors and that there are opportunities and modes and methods that are designed towards capturing information about virtually every one of our activities, both as individuals with geotagged and geotraced information about our whereabouts, about the people that we are associating with, and even trying to infer our intentions and model our future behavior. And we see things, you know, there's a whole lot of noise in this chart about urban monitoring and measurement, you know, personal travel assistant, and smart transportation pricing. And, you know, it's arguable that Cisco even knows what this means. But it's definitely consecrated to the idea that predictive analytics will be brought to bear on just about everything that is done in the urban environment, which gives the duly appointed and credentialed administrators of the city the ability to conduct remote observation and control on our affairs, to intervene before a circumstance has quite arisen. And typically, the images that were offered that are associated with this discourse look like this. These are both from the MIT Sensible City Lab, an organization which has been in the forefront of helping to figure out how we draw information from sensors into analytic engines and deriving visualizations, pattern recognition, and understanding the flow and the evolution of dense and complex and dynamic urban systems. So these are the sorts of images that were offered from them. But something that kind of crops up right away is that very, very rarely do we talk about the question of provenance. In this particular discourse, we almost never talk about who made the data that we're looking at and that the representation that we're being offered. With its weird kind of realist epistemology, its claim to representing the city as it really is, we're never told how this information got into the analytic engine to begin with. How did it arise? How was it gathered? Was it gathered, you know, by a beacon? So this bleb, this rather ugly and hostile-looking bleb on the wall is an Estimote beacon. And it's gathering location information from the person with the mobile device. And it's pushing them back in a special offer for a 50% coupon on a pair of shoes. That's one way of gathering data. That's a very, very typical scenario that's involved and bound up in this sort of representation of the world. But there are other ways. maybe a little bit old-fashioned even. I mean, this is from a Haringey-based enterprise called Living Under One Sun. They were given a grant to study patterns of mobility, and particularly choices of mode switching in urban transportation. And instead of doing the sort of phone survey that other councils did, they went door-to-door. And most interestingly, they paid students, unemployed people, people at risk in the community, elderly people, £10 an hour to go door-to-door and do this. Not merely did they gather better, more granular, and more accurate information about that community and its transportation habits than the other councils in London, but the experience was transformative for the people who were entrusted with this task. Now, this seems like a very simple intervention. This seems like, frankly, kind of retrograde. It's like, yeah, people walking down the street with paper and pen records that they're later on going to feed into a spreadsheet. What is so advanced about that? What is advanced about that is entrusting them with a comprehensive explanation about what it is they're trying to achieve, asking them to participate actively in gathering this data, and even to some degree interpreting it, because as you know, there's no such thing as pure data. There are always edge cases, there are always places where, you know, a record is returned to you is not particularly legible. Somebody has to interpret that. By entrusting these people who otherwise are not particularly high status in any register with the awareness that they are responsible for the future of funding for their own community, it is, you know, that old word empowering, right? There's something real about that. But there are also questions that big data never asks about how the people who generated the data in the first place can gain access to it and make use of it themselves. This is a very interesting image from a project called C-Plan out of Oslo, which took the city's open public planning permissions database and visualized all of the connections between actors and institutions in it. So you could get a sense for who was benefiting from the expenditure of public money and the expenditure of private money in the development of the Oslo city center. You could get a sense from who the really powerful actors were and how often they intervened in the landscape. And since each one of them was made public, you could intervene yourself to some degree, at least theoretically, in decisions that affected you in ways that you found to be deleterious. We never ask of big data what it is that we can do with it ourselves. And it's an open question. It may not always be possible to take purchase of this data. Even if it's opened up, even if we have access to it, it may not be possible to act effectively upon it, given the social and institutional limitations which confront us. This is a visualization of power structures, again, in sort of an urban regeneration context, this time in Istanbul. Knowing this doesn't necessarily mean that we can act on it in any politically satisfactory way, but it does create constituencies, it does create desires, it does create demands, and it ultimately presents at least the possibility of coalitions coming together to act meaningfully on this. The deepest question of all, though, is what does the work of making data make of us? Here again is a participatory mapping exercise. This is Transparent Chennai. This is a group of slum dwellers in India who were asked to map access to toilets in their communities. And they did use that when it was entered into an online digital map to make effective demands on their representatives in government. They were able to take advantage of this power of distributed network tool sets and use it to make meaningful, concrete, visceral difference in their lives. And it made of them a community where previously they had just been an assembly of people who lived in proximity to one another. Undertaking this project fused them into an effective collective. So that's a little bit of thinking about people making data. What about people making things? Well, I think that we have a very exciting potential before us with, again, access to digital networked production and manufacturing and fabrication technologies. The prospect of adaptive upcycling. Adaptive upcycling is my name for something very old, actually. I mean, the process of repair and the logic of repair is something that's familiar to most people, not merely in the global south, but increasingly in the developed world as well, with the economic and material and environmental pressures upon us. The idea that we can make new use of all of the sunk energy and investment in manufactured objects has acquired a renewed credibility. What I want to talk about is an entirely new culture of repair that's based on the use of digital fabrication technologies like 3D printing and CNC milling and water cutting that has recourse to repositories of freely downloadable specifications. So a free and open source intellectual property regime that shares the design of things for free, for anybody to have access to, for anybody to download the specification file for any of these parts or components, download that to their CNC milling machine or their router, and making things. These machines being deployed in small, clean, environmentally sound city center workshops that are themselves under democratic community control. What are the sorts of things that you can make with these technologies? What do I mean when I talk about a culture of repair and adaptive upcycling? Let's say that you happen to have an air compressor engine that has worn its way through its old housing and is apparently, at this point, not really fit for service. It's an enormously complicated and expensive machine in some contexts, and the work that you do might rely critically upon you having access to a functioning machine, but for the loss of one component of that machine that may no longer be in active production, the housing. Well, if you have access to a CNC milling machine or a 3D printer, you can measure the machine, evoke a specification file, download that file to the milling machine, make for a very, very low cost, on the order of American cents, really, an extruded or a fabricated housing, and return the entire thing to active use, return the entire thing to useful service. Similarly, here we see an example of an old gasoline motor where the gas tank, the cap, was missing, and it was just inoperable without the gas cap. So somebody measured the threading very carefully and fabricated a cap. These are the sorts of repairs that will make maximum use of the investments that we've already made in building objects. All of the millions, billions of things that are already out there, that are already paid for, that are easy to return to active service and productivity if only we can fabricate for very, very low cost these replacement pieces and components. But these are not the only things we can do with these technologies. They can be scaled up as well. This is a project called WikiHouse. This was the deployment of WikiHouse in Rio. The whole idea of WikiHouse, it's part of what's called an open source hardware culture. And the idea, again, is that there are online repositories of the components and plans, specification files for building a house using the lowest, the cheapest amount of materials, most efficiently, most readily, in a way that only two or three people can assemble it. Recently in China, this logic has been taken to its logical conclusion. They've taken the whole notion of extruded 3D printing to industrial scale. This is a 3D printer printing the components of buildings, which are then erected in almost no time. This entire building was constructed in less than a day by a crew of three people. It's glued together. In places that have limitations on the available housing, this is obviously something that has to be looked on with a great deal of interest. It isn't a panacea. One of the things that I think is a lesson that gets learned and relearned when people try to intervene in favelas and slum communities is that there's actually a local culture of repair and a local ecosystem of material that circulates in the community, whether it's aluminum siding or PVC piping, and that there are people who have built their entire lives, not merely their livelihoods, but their status in the community and their sense of themselves around their facility with these things. So this is a disruptive technology in the sense that if you deployed it in that context, it would disrupt those ecosystems and those loops. But I think the decision as to whether to adopt it and deploy it has to be made by each community on its own. These are extremely competent, capable technologies that can do amazing things, again, at very low material input and very low cost. And I think it would be a shame if we didn't adopt this ethos of less mass, more data. But again, only in the context of digital fabrication as an element of a conscious socio-technic ecology. When it is deployed in that mode, it has the capacity for generating self-reliance and a sense of competence with what are otherwise ordinarily thought of and positioned as advanced technologies that require specialist attending. And you begin to shift from an external to an internal locus of control. When confronted with an emergent situation, you no longer wait around for the availability of something. You begin to think of ways in which you might build your response yourself, in which you might actively, creatively use the capacities around you to respond to the exigencies that might otherwise seem like they're out of control. It is, in a very deep sense, a technology of conviviality. not merely social conviviality, but really, truly, deeply living together. And we can take it a step further still. People making places. And I'll explain in just a moment what that means. We hear all the time about urban infill and even about urban acupuncture. I think these are limited metaphors. I think that the thing that we need to be thinking of, especially given the context of the technologies we have available to us, is something called, or that I call, urban kintsukuroi. Kintsukuroi is a Japanese word that means golden repair, and in practice it looks a little bit like this. When you shatter a bowl or piece of ceramic pottery, you can actually anneal it and fuse it together with gold seaming. The aim is not just restoration, but improvement. And I think an articulated and conscious practice of kintsukuroi at the urban scale could be very interesting indeed. I'm put in mind of a place I'm familiar with in Aarhus, Denmark, a place called Godsbanen, which includes something called the Institute for X. This was Godsbanen a couple of years ago. It was a freight train terminal in the center of town, abandoned, not in particularly good shape, not used for anything, and beginning to attract the sorts of untoward activities that just about any sort of sacrifice zone of that nature eventually begins to aggregate around it. This is Godsbanen today. It was very consciously and by the state chosen to receive investment as a place where people would come together and fabricate an alternative themselves. Godsbanen today is not merely a state-supported and funded series of workshops, but it extends into an entirely community-led, community-driven, democratically operated and managed set of circumstances called the Institute for X. This is what it looks like. It is a clear improvement on what was there before, and the workshops, including things like fabric and textile workshops, clay workshops, and of course CNC milling and cutting, do begin to substantiate this promise of city center on-demand digital fabrication. And when you see this working in real time, in real life, when you see the kinds of people who operate the equipment and what they make of it, and when you listen to them talk about what their lives were like before and after, you do start to get a little bit enthusiastic. You start to get carried away by their enthusiasm. And you start to recognize that what they've turned these technologies towards is not merely a need that is felt in Aarhus, Denmark, but is in fact a more general need. We should consider the history of Manchester, the cradle of the Industrial Revolution, but no longer quite the same thing. This is an abandoned train yard in Manchester, typical of a great many abandoned buildings. When industry flees a place, we know what happens. We know what happens to people's psychology. We know what happens to their sense of the possible. We know what happens to their sense of themselves. This is what happens. They lose connection to any kind of ambition or any kind of sense that their actions matter. They become profoundly cynical, and justly so, because there really isn't anything out there. But what if we could take the fabrication technologies that we're talking about, use in the modes and in the metaphors and the contexts that we've been talking about, to turn these abandoned sites into workshops, into places where digital technologies are used to fabricate things that people want and need. These are two places where it was being done in London, actually. This is a place just off Brick Lane called Unto This Last. And this is a pop-up shop called Assemble and Join. I love that name, Assemble and Join. It's a beautiful way of conveying exactly what it is that they do. These are the people that work there. Sites like this have direct economic benefit for their communities. But they also give rise to what we might think of as an import substitution dynamic, where instead of paying high margins for things that people need, you produce them locally, and again, using less mass, more data, for low cost and with lower investment. You wind up serving actual needs and not artificially propagated desires, or so I believe. You wind up also surfacing the latent community and turning it into an active community of practice, a community of interest, a community of solidarity. You build capacity in many senses. And that's what leads me to the final thing that I'd like to consider, people making networks. The city itself, as a matter of fact, is a giant meshwork. There are dangers of over-valorizing do-it-yourself, small-scale, local production, as there are dangers of valorizing anything that's local and small-scale and tightly turned in towards its own horizon. There are issues of scale. There are issues of technical sophistication. There are issues of expense. So ideally, the workshops and the moments of Kintsukuroi and the data gathering circumstances that we've talked about would be coordinated at metropolitan scale. They would be digital sites, digitally connected. But when you begin to move in size from groups like this one in Istanbul, or this one in New York City, or this one in Medellin, or this one in Madrid, up to this size in New York, you begin to lose coherence. You begin to require a set of tools to help you manage discourse, dissensus, decision-making, and fact-finding. It is possible that we can create networks. I mean, this is a volunteer for the Red Hook Wireless Initiative. She's installing a wireless router on a rooftop. Even if we don't have access to the official networks, we can build networks of our own. Increasingly, the technical trend is towards something called ad hoc mesh networking, which allows each device to form active connections to others in real time as it needs it. I'm less worried about the bandwidth in the background than the deliberative technology in the foreground, and the interfaces and the applications that interpose themselves between us and whatever decision we're trying to make. We need an architecture of participation. Now, there are people who are thinking about this task, thinking about this set of concerns and issues. Very, very bright people. People are trying to take the lessons of the Occupy movement and all of the sort of intimate technologies of decision-making and dissensus and discourse that were devised during the Occupy movement and make them an online interface. This is a screenshot from a product called Lumio, which comes out of Wellington, New Zealand. This is a screenshot and some pointers around a project called InterTwinkles. These are decision support and fact-finding environments in which you can bring digital data to bear. What I like about them is that they emphasize the idea that democracy is a process, not an event. It's not about, you know, an up or down vote at this particular moment in time. Like virtue, it is a process. It's something that is invested in over time that has a great deal to do with how community is able to act in the world once it has acquired competence with the tools and the techniques of democratic decision making. These things, in my experience, have tended to be based, though not at all, on elaborate technologies. When I worked with Occupy Sandy, what I saw at very close range was that what that initiative and that effort really subsisted on were robust, decentralized, and well-assimilated technologies that were well down what the Gartner consulting firm thinks of as the trough of disillusionment. These are technologies that we've had for years that have no glamour left associated or attached to them, that can be had at very, very, very low cost. Things like text messaging, things like Google Docs even. Commodity devices, reliable access to connectivity, and better generic cloud services. You have these things, secure, particularly secure cloud services, which is the issue around giving all of your data to Google. If you have these things, you have the potential to transform the city into a mere assembly of people who happen to live together, into collectives of data-making citizen actors, thing-making citizen actors, place-making citizen actors, and network-making citizen actors. And they can even combine with one another multiplicatively. For example, it's entirely possible to conceive, here are some volunteers from the Red Hook Wireless Initiative. You know, they require physical objects to do their job. It's super easy for me to see certain ones of those objects being fabricated locally at close to zero cost instead of being bought on the market. Can this be done? Can complicated technical affairs be coordinated autonomously by previously unaffiliated groups of untrained, non-specialist, amateur volunteers? My experience argues that it can. Now, here are some screenshots from, again, Occupy Sandy. Occupy Sandy was a relief effort in New York City after Superstorm Sandy in October of 2012. New York, in the United States of America, you know, there are official emergency management organizations that are dedicated to crises like this. There's the Federal Emergency Management Agency. There's the American Red Cross. These are enormously powerful, well-organized, hierarchically centralized command and control organizations with enormous budgets and access to resource material, equipment, and staffing. And yet this group, which came together on a few hours' notice after the storm hit, made up entirely of volunteers who were veterans of the previous fall's Occupy effort, came together and figured out how to do, essentially, a logistics distribution operation that managed to take hundreds of volunteers and thousands of pieces of equipment, donated supplies, construction material, and hot meals to dozens of relief sites more effectively than the hierarchically organized command and control organizations that were given that task nominally and officially. I mean, they were horizontal, they were leaderless, they were guided only by their ambitions and their ideology, but they made it happen. Similarly, in Detroit, when tens of thousands of citizens had their water cut off, a bottom-up group that was, again, comprised of veterans of the Occupy movement formed something called Detroit Water Brigade and essentially magicked a water distribution infrastructure into being at metropolitan scale in the heart of one of the cities of the developed north at a time in which that wasn't supposed to be possible. So I think if we want to do these kinds of things, we probably can do them. There's historical evidence as well. During the Spanish Civil War, the anarchist CNT and FAI unions ran highly technical organizations and services like the tram network and like the telephone exchange. And they were able to do that successfully, again, organized on horizontal leaderless lines, until they were literally bombed out by the fascists. You know, there is nothing to suggest that they couldn't have kept doing that as or more efficiently than the systems that were in place before. So, you know, to conclude, I'm articulating a whole bunch of suggestions about ways in which we might do things. And they may seem kind of inchoate, they may seem like they don't particularly have much connection with one another, but I would argue to you that they do in fact constitute the beginnings of a new way of doing things, a new way of approaching urbanity itself. It might seem to be, to use a term that's beloved of the technology community, a city and a way of organizing cities that is in perpetual beta, which is to say in a perpetual process of becoming. But I want to share a notion that's drawn from the study of complex dynamic systems, the notion of metastability, which is the notion that a dynamic system can occupy more than one stable state as it evolves over time, and that the one that happens to occupy at the moment may only be a local maximum, may only be literally a matter of habit as the system evolves. So all it takes sometimes is one nudge to take the system out of the basin that it's currently occupying, the basin of attraction that it's currently occupying, and tilt its behavior over into an entirely different but equally stable way of doing things. My guess is that a moment like that is upon us, but I don't know what that other stable state looks like. You know, depopulation and devastation, it's an incredibly stable state. You don't get much more stable than that. So, you know, it's entirely possible that that's the sort of outcome that we're looking at. I would prefer to believe, though, that it's a more fruitful future that we're looking at. I don't believe it's a future that's going to look much like the prognostications of the vendors responsible for the smart city. I don't believe it's going to look shiny and clean and futuristic like this. I think it's going to look a lot more like an allotment garden. And this happens to be a rather nice allotment garden. I particularly find it pleasant to look at, but I can see where some people would look at this image and see chaos. I think this is what our lives are going to look like with the technologies that we use, and this is sort of a best-case outcome, mind you. I think our lives are going to be messy. I think our cities are going to be contentious. I think we will find that they are unfinished and never to be finished. But I think, like an allotment garden, we will also find that they are a place where things are growing. Things with utility, value, and worth. Beautiful things. But I'm very wary of this word, potential. I have had my feet held to the fire about using this word. Bruno Latour teaches us that potential is a conjecture about things that you haven't bothered to set out to prove yet. And there is a cost that's involved in doing the experimentation that's necessary to prove things. It takes work. As a matter of fact, in this context, it takes a fight. But the result of that fight, that investment of passionate energy and intention, I believe, would be a city worth fighting for. And I'd like to conclude with some thoughts by a man that I'm not crazy about. It's a guy named James Howard Kunstler. He's very cranky. He's very negative on the whole project of civilization and maybe even humanity in general. But he did say this beautiful thing. He said, if there is any positive side to stark changes coming our way, and he very definitely believes that there are stark and unpleasant changes coming our way, it may be in the benefits of close communal relations, of having to really work intimately and physically with our neighbors, to be a part of an enterprise that really matters, and to be fully engaged in meaningful social enactments instead of merely entertained to avoid boredom. Well, you couldn't diagnose contemporary information technology. He concludes by saying, years from now, when we hear singing at all, we will hear ourselves, and we will sing with our whole hearts. And I very much believe that to be the case. Take care of each other. Thank you very much for your time and your attention.
Thank you very much. That was really inspiring, actually. Thank you. Okay, we'll have our respondent now, maybe straight away. That would be great. Welcome, Leo.
Thank you very much. I've always wondered what it was like to stand here. I've always been at the back watching and listening and really feeling that this was one of the most exciting places. This was the crossroads of so much of the sort of urban thinking that has informed the way that I think about the city and the way that I think about the world. So I'm deeply privileged to be here. I was asked to respond to Adam's call to the barricade, and I feel in no way qualified to do so. So instead, perhaps I might just ride on his tailcoats instead. As Adam was sort of saying, that I like this notion of perpetual beta. And I think perhaps if we are on the barricades, what we are facing and what we're fighting is the alpha city. And perhaps that is something that is worth, I suppose, just aiming at, even if it's just tilting at a windmill. Before Adam came to London, I was a huge fan of his writing. I first came across him and I thought that he was a technology writer who wrote about the city. It was only after reading Against Smart Cities and meeting Adam himself that I came to discover that he was a practitioner and a thinker who was much more than that. So often we like to think that technology is on one side and the city is on the other, and we're dealing with some kind of rough coming together of these two different things. But Adam has really helped me think that these were in fact one and the same place. And so there are three very quick, I suppose, sort of motifs that I want to think about and talk about here and just raise, not in necessarily response to Adam's talk, which I think takes some deep thought and consideration, but just perhaps to sort of inspire a different sort of threads of an argument. And I'm really thinking about that relationship within the city, that place where technology and the city are one rather than two things that are rubbing up against each other. Because I think, actually, despite all these claims that we have for the smart city or for the way that technology is going to transform ourselves, this marriage is a difficult one. I don't know how many of you saw the pictures in The Guardian this morning of the new mobile phone lane in Chongqing. This is a lane that they've devised for people who are texting and walking at the same time. It seems as if rather than getting people to behave slightly better or slightly more sensible, it's easier to give them a space to the city. And this sent me back to a wonderful report that was produced from Queensland in January. Early this year, coming with the fantastically dull title of Texting and Walking, Strategies for Postural Control and the Implications for Safety. And what this report showed that was, in fact, while most pedestrian injuries statistics are down, injured walking around the city while texting was on the rise. Recent report from Airy County Medical Centre said 10% of all accidents were caused by walking and texting, and this was particularly true amongst the 16 to 25-year-olds.
I thought you were going to say it was particularly true amongst Australians.
No, it's a particular 16 to 25-year-olds, so most of us are out of the zone, thankfully. But the study also demonstrated that those who text and walk do slower walking speeds, greater deviation from the straight path, and increased absolute lateral step deviation in conjunction with increased rotation ROM of the head in global space. What this basically, I think, tells us is that walking while you're looking at the phone slows you down, makes you meander and weave as if you were drunk, and can get you killed. This is very different from the optimized and perfect city that this sort of supposedly connected smart city is going to deliver. And in opposition to this, in many ways, I want to respond with another image, perhaps something where will help us try and form an idea of what this barricade is and where it may be located. In 1969, William H. White, who was an editor of Fortune magazine, he was the first person to commission Jane Jacobs to write for that magazine, was given the job of sort of head planner of New York, so following on from Robert Moses. And he discovered, when he came into the office, that no one had bothered to go back to any of the projects that had occurred over the last few decades to see whether they were successful or not, whether people were using them in the way that was intended, or even what people were using the city for. So he decided, as one of the first things, was that he was going to hire a number of students from the local Hunter College and just watch people. And he set certain locations within the city, such as Seagram Plaza. And one of the most interesting places that he set over one summer's week was outside Fifth Saks, one of the major, I suppose, shopping spaces within the city. And he wanted to see where people moved about, how they sort of communicated on what was more or less a midtown ordinary city corner. And so he watched, and over a number of days, he calculated and plotted where a conversation that occurred more than 2 minutes actually took place. And he discovered that more often than not, it was either outside the front door of the shop or on the street corner. Now, if you're going to design a city for people to stop and have a chat and get in the way of absolutely everyone else, this is the way to do it. I think what this sort of study proved is that actually we don't use the city in the way that perhaps we plan it to be used. That a street corner should be a place of crossing, of traversing, of movement, but actually this is the places where we meet. And so when we think about, I think, Adam's idea of the barricade, perhaps we should also think about the street corner, this place where so often we've thought of it as a place to move on, but actually it's a place where we stick, where we bump into other people, where we have chance encounters. Because it's actually on the street corner in these public spaces where the barricade is going to be set up. This is where the messiness of the city really can emerge and become incredibly creative for the city. And so when the Alpha City is being planned, they're probably going to try and wipe away the street corners. And so this is where we need to put up our barricade. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sorry for my little guy, I'm Australian, you know. Right. Oh, well, that's sort of excellent timing. Well done. Well, we have got half an hour for questions and comments, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what people have got, what responses there are, what people have got to say. So are there any hands up immediately? Anybody want to get us going? Ah, excellent. Would you just say your name?
Hang on, we're going to have a mic coming out to you.
Hello. I'm Gilbert. Part of me feels like an idiot for asking this question, but I'm going to sort of do it anyway. And it's when you were talking about the idea of being presented with all this information, like the Istanbul example, I think you saw, and a way that a lot of it's kind of mediated in sort of private firms, and the idea is at the end of it that you're going to have something sold to you, or the information is some way going to be used for their benefit. And I was wondering if you had any views on the responsibilities of governments or councils to perhaps in some way mediate that information in a way that is... Sorry.
To do what?
Should they be mediating that information in a way that is for the benefit of everyone rather than letting individual companies with their blue carbuncles on the walls have control over it, because at the moment it really does seem to be only something that you get from private enterprises, be they generous in some form, or perhaps, as usually, there's an IPO or something behind it and it's not really as generous as you think it is.
Yeah, it's a great question, actually, and you shouldn't feel stupid for asking it. The sort of canonical neoliberal answer is that that is a question that's outside the competence of the state to determine, and that, you know, it's the state's obligation to present a level playing field to all actors and let the market decide. You know, and whoever thrives in the market is the one that was meant to, and you know, all is well and good in the world. And I think that we know that that's not a particularly satisfactory answer. But there is a grain of truth in it, as far as I'm concerned, which is that it's very, very hard to know a priori, or as we would say in the industry, at design time, exactly what uses technologies and data streams will be put to. You know, as Leo kind of indicates, it's the unplanned collisions that are so often fruitful, both in everyday life and where two data streams converge. You never know who's going to be able to take hold of some particular source of data and mash it up or connect it to another source of information in a way that really is fruitful to people. That's a very, very heavy burden to ask a local council to shoulder. And so I think that we have no alternative but to kind of muddle through with this. Clearly, the neoliberal answer isn't a very satisfying one. But it is, you know, beyond saying that we're going to open up access to these infrastructures and make sure that to wherever there is a public investment in infrastructure, all of the members of the community have access to it and the ability to use it, the wherewithal to use it. Beyond doing that, I'm not sure that we can say ahead of time, you know, this doesn't sit well with us. Now, after the fact is a different question. And this is where, to some degree, you know, I think, I don't know if it's obvious, but I always think of myself as kind of my soul is split down the middle. And on one side of that line is an anarchist and the other side is a social democrat. And it's you know, it's a nightmare to live that way, believe me. But, you know, there's a part of me that does believe in the ability and the responsibility of the state to regulate. And so, for example, in Germany, you see, you know, after the fact, basically saying to Google, well, we're not comfortable with Street View. We don't think that you're capturing all of that information about German citizens on German streets suits the prerogatives of the German community. And they've basically said that's forbidden, you know, throughout Europe. As a matter of fact, privacy laws are more restrictive in general as they are in the United States or elsewhere. So, you know, while there are state apparatuses and while they are entrusted with that sort of decision-making ability and capacity, I think that there's a lot of wisdom in asking them to regulate on our behalf. And as long as they're accountable to us, as long as they're recallable by us, and as long as they are seen to be acting in what we believe to be our interests, then allowing them to regulate on that basis.
I mean, I think I'm in agreement with that. I think, sadly, I'm not always so sure, despite wanting it to be so, but that governments and councils have the public's best interest at heart. I say this because earlier this year I sort of sitting down with coffee with somebody who was involved in the, as it were, the sort of data transformation of a major London borough, and he was just saying actually what they were going to be doing with their big data collection was being able to reduce the council to a commissioning body. So you know, these bodies should be things that will be able to regulate the city, but I think, you know, you can't always trust them to do that job.
Maybe just a small clarification. You were talking about this question of communities and scale, and we know that small communities can work really well. We know that to an extent they can grow, and then through experience, through knowledge, also through ideology, as you say, they can you can work at larger scales. But all of these are also aspects of exclusion. So I also wonder, to what extent are you actually not talking about citizens, but actually cliques?
Well, I hope that I'm not talking about cliques. I do use the word citizen, conscious that it is not a particularly universal term. And as a matter of fact, I'm not a citizen of this place as I sit here.
and that when we talk about the urban subject, we might be better advised to say urban subject, because we very often do not mean literally citizen, and it is a very dangerous knife edge to walk. I mean collectivities of people, and I think that the greater the extent to which the circumstances of people's lives they're able to participate in some wise, generally and broadly, the healthier that is for everybody. That's healthier for individuals, and it's healthier for the communities that they belong to. Is it necessarily the case that everybody will always find a community to belong to, or that everybody will be welcome in a community? No, clearly not. Is it the case, as I've already indicated, that you know localism is just as often a cudgel that's used to beat people from outside with? Absolutely it is. I don't have a good answer to that, but I do think that a world that's organized as sort of a federation of distributed collectives of that nature, I hate to do this, but I'm going to generalize from my own experience. The best moments of my life have been when I surrendered all of the accoutrements of status and all of the privileges that otherwise would fall upon me and just participated as an anonymous member of the collective that was making Occupy Sandy happen. Those were by far the most gratifying experiences of my life, and I was doing very little more than moving boxes from one place to another as part of a bucket brigade. And I did that for, you know, a while. I wasn't a very particularly intimately involved member of Occupy Sandy, but I was there. And I think that the circumstances of our existence at present, I don't know if everybody will agree, I think they're degrading. I think they degrade us. I think they literally degrade us. They degrade our capacity. They degrade our competence. They leave us feeling afraid. They leave us in a state of precarity. And I have to imagine that circumstances that do anything to redress that have to be very salutary indeed.
We often have the sort of feeling that you know, being part of a crowd and being part of a group, we lose something. There was a very interesting study that was produced in, I think, November last year from Hatfield University, which looked at two different events. One was a concert on Brighton Beach by Fatboy Slim, and the other one was a march for the unions in 2007. And it located both where you were in the crowd and how your sort of sense of being part of something, almost a sort of sense of satisfaction or happiness. And it proved that actually being in the centre and being, you know, as it were, committed to the group brought about an extra sort of sense of participation, of being part of the collective. Now, the thing that interests me is how that is connected to place. And actually, you need to be in a place in order to do that. I think technology is extremely good at connecting people and informing people, but nothing matters until you actually get into that place and you pick up that box and you join that march. And that is when, that is the moment, or there is something that occurs that, if you want to call it citizenship, that's when that occurs.
Hi, I'm from a campaign called Priced Out, which they campaigned for affordable housing. And I noticed that there were lots of photos of industrial decay and spaces that we can occupy in cities. But in London, as I'm sure you must be aware, there's not very much space anymore. And we're not at the stage as a society where we're sort of happy to accept shantytowns or that kind of sort of use of space. So what do we do when the cities fill up?
Well, I suppose that answer has to vary by the individual. I mean, some of us will just say, like, I'm tired of beating my head against this wall. I'm leaving. I'm going elsewhere. I'm seeking my fortune elsewhere. Some of us will say, I was born here, and I'll be damned if I'm leaving. I can't see that there's any global answer to that. What I will say is that I can see there being a moment at time when we will be forced by the evolution of circumstances to be more flexible than either our current law, our current habit, or our current practice allows. I don't know if that will look like shantytowns per se, or favelas, or slums, or sort of emergent, you know, Hoovervilles on the outskirts of town, as we used to call them in the United States. But it might. And it might also look like something a little bit more baroque and technologized and extruded from a fabricator. I guess that's part of my point, really, is that we don't know. Once we've rolled the dice, we don't know which way the dice will come up, and the best we can do is try to steer them in the direction that we think is most fruitful to us. That would include, as far as I'm concerned, housing as a universal right. That seems fairly obvious to me. But as you point out, I think we're a long way from that right now.
I mean, I think there is space in London, and certainly enough space. We don't have to start sort of building outside quite yet. I think that also there are, although they're incredibly well hidden, there are bits of informal housing and sort of shanty towns all over. It's not necessarily in one area. There is a sort of archipelago of places. Certainly, I know from around where I live, street front looks absolutely fine, but you then look into people's gardens and there are these sort of huts that are full of people living there. So I think there is, you know, we have got to that stage where you know, we have to sort of start taking this kind of informal housing seriously. I completely agree with Adam that the two issues here is really who is the city for and the right to the city. And I suspect everyone in this room probably believes that everyone should have a right to the city. How we deal with that, I think, is very much a thorny issue. But I suspect that if we start from that premise, we can start thinking about solutions. But if we start thinking that it has to be an alpha city that provides, or it has to be, we have to decide who's in and who's out, then problems will really start to occur.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Mark, and I work as an architect. I've got a comment and a question.
Sorry,
really.
I couldn't hear.
My name's Mark, and I have a comment and a question as well. It was great to see Mayfield Station in Manchester, which, in fact, I did a competition proposal for about 10 years ago, I think, where, in fact, we proposed it being a caravan park and encouraging people to come and actually visit perhaps the more deprived communities to the east of there, but which actually have a lot of history and interest to them. It was,
well, there's an answer to the housing question, right?
Yeah, it was airstreams, so it was very sort of architectural. So I suppose the reason it's not been developed since is probably because the developers who owns it's probably sat on it waiting for it to a suitable use to come to fruition. But my question was, as an architect, once my designs are all posted online and people are off busily building their own houses and, I guess by extrapolation, schools and hospitals, unless perhaps we've re-engineered our current sickness system so that we don't need hospitals anymore, what sort of positive future do you sort of posit for myself, my colleagues, when we're not needed anymore?
As designers? I mean, you'll always be needed as designers. Whether you can make a living doing that is a separate question. I think that you know, what happens to musicians first ultimately happens to everybody else. It's beginning to happen to authors and artists and happen to architects, too. I have to be very careful because, you know, my editor / publisher is in the room. How should I put this? I don't think any one of us is owed a living by our creative output. I think what we do have is a right to some kind of minimum subsistence standard. We have the right to the basic outlay of, you know, what we might call existence minimum. But as a writer, I don't believe that I have the right to make a living from my writing. I write because I can't help but write, and that's the way I think through the challenges and the problems that confront me. I would imagine, I'm guessing, that you probably sketch through things, and that's something that you can't help but doing. It may not seem particularly compassionate of me to say this, but I don't think any one of us has the absolute right to earn our crust from doing the thing that we can't help to do. What we are required is to keep doing that. And I think you'll find that makes you valuable in ways outside the merely pecuniary. I think you will always be an asset to whatever community you're a part of, by dint of the fact that you've had that education, you have those predilections, and you know how to design. I think that will make you an extraordinarily valuable component of a community and somebody that people are very grateful to have around.
Mm-hmm. Should we take more than one at a time, actually, because we've got a few Gosh, we've got quite a lot left. Can I take two at a time? Can you cope?
We can try.
Okay.
Do our best.
Take this one, yeah.
You've talked a lot about kind of volunteer-run amateur kind of projects, and I think you're completely right that people are really good at coming together in those situations. I was wondering how, when you remove kind of the motivations of government or profiteering, how do you make sure that schemes like that carry on? So if you have like a community garden, as an example, you have the people that start it and then they harvest it twice, and then what happens when they move on, especially since cities are so transient kind of by nature?
Okay, and can we take... yes, chap with the beard.
That could be anybody in this car.
The guy with the beard and the glasses.
Yeah.
Hello. I was wondering about scaling up, which has already been asked. I was part of the Occupy Madrid, this 15M and that, and what happened, it was the contrary that you showed. So what happened is it was that the big assembly that was built, like Occupy London or Occupy New York, split into the neighborhoods. So the way was the other way around. And in fact, one of the places that you showed, which is this Campo de la Cebada, which is this place in Madrid, I've been studying it for a while. I would like to know, what you think about community, because it's like a buzzword, I think. It's in my opinion, and if that community is made out of unskilled voluntaries, because in fact what happens is that they really struggle to just keep on doing things because they don't have money to keep on building, and we shouldn't praise that way of doing cities unless we have a way to live through, a wage or something.
Well, the first way I'd respond is that, I hope I didn't give the impression through that series of pictures of ever larger groups that I thought that was an evolutionary pathway or that things naturally evolved in that direction. All I was saying is that the problems of coordination and communication get much more serious and harder to deal with as you move from 5 people, 20 people, up through the Dunbar number of 150, which I think is probably the largest practical group size, up to thousands, not suggesting at all that that is how groups evolve or even ought to evolve. The question of under-skilled or under-resourced initiatives, and I think it goes also to the question of what you do when passion just isn't enough, or the most passionate people are kind of the only ones left at the core of a project. And to some degree, things have lifetimes. The trouble is, as you point out, that services, that we need to rely upon in the background have much longer lifetimes. Like, we need to be able to rely on the carrying capacity of the city. We need to be able to rely on the streets and the sewerage and the electrical power. And these are not things which you would expect unskilled people to be able to do. You would certainly not be able to expect people to do it on a voluntary basis. I have to say, I have seen with my own eyes people acquiring what are generally regarded as fairly technical skills. And I have to say that I've been very impressed with people's ability, admittedly under a fair amount of pressure, so incentive, to evolve the capabilities that they require to deal with those sorts of infrastructures relatively rapidly. And I have seen them over the course of months carry on. I've also seen that come to an end. Essentially. I mean, there is still an Occupy Sandy meeting. There is still an Occupy Sandy network. But they have not created the permanent infrastructure, in New York City at least, that I might have expected. Some people would say that that's not a problem. Other people would say if you're articulating a logic that's based on that sort of thing, it's a major lacuna and you should try to address that. I think that exigency and need dictate a lot of things in life, and that should we actually happen to require the vegetables that we grow in community gardens, and we'd very quickly discover
that it's not simply something that has to compete with watching the game or meeting our friends down the pub, but it would be something that would captivate our attention on a more reliable basis. And I do frankly think that that is likely to be the tenor and the texture of the world that we're entering and we'll live the rest of our lives in, one where these aren't fripperies and they aren't lifestyle assertions and they aren't things that we try on for size. They're actually the way that we make the systems that we rely upon work. And I have no further capacity to speak meaningfully to that because, as I say, I try not to speak about potential. We try to speak about experiments that determine whether or not something, in fact, was a possibility or was not a possibility. So until we enter into that circumstance, I don't know, but that is what my gut is telling me.
I mean, there's nothing less utopian than, a garden committee that don't agree with each other. It's hard. It's incredibly hard. And there is a sort of sense often that after a big event, after an explosion, there is a half-life, and then real life gets back, and it becomes difficult. And this is very true. One needs to sort of see the difference between the event and then the long-term occupation of a space. I do think the importance of having a space sometimes is much easier than just having a committee. That, you know, if you actually sort of come to that place and maintain that place. I mean, I'm not going to get into some sort of utopian Candide kind of idea that you dig the garden and everything will be fine. That's not going to happen. I think but what one needs to sort of recognise is that it does occur, and there is longevity. I'm thinking here, there's Justin McQuirk here, who wrote a book very much about activist architecture in Latin America, and I think there are some really choice examples of things that have had lasting impact, that they were, as it were, sort of small-scale events, but they've had real deep impact on the city.
I think there's also a rhythm, sort of a peristaltic rhythm that happens where, we've already spoken that it was the experience of Occupy Wall Street, which a lot of people would probably argue didn't really accomplish much of anything. It was the networks and the capacities that were formed in that event that allowed Occupy Sandy to stand up overnight when Sandy hit. So I think that there is this sense of kind of, events that create affinities, they create desires, and they create capacities that are later called upon at different times. And in that sense, maybe that's the longitudinal survival of these things.
Right, we haven't got very long left, so, okay, I know you've had your hand up for a long time, and perhaps this chap at the back.
Okay.
Yep.
Nika McDonald, a co-author of a manifesto called Big Potatoes, which is an innovation manifesto. I'm interested in the political framework that you see your work in and wary of being too either techno or design centric, as I'm sure you are. And it seems to me the solution should flow from a broader political understanding and even program. And you gave the example of the CNT in Barcelona, presumably in the 1930s and the Spanish Civil War. And in that context, their objective was not per se designing a better tram system, it was retaining political power, actually, because the Republicans had the political power. And that was a bigger project. It was socialism, syndicalism, anarchism, communism, what have you got? And I don't see that in your political philosophy, and maybe just things have moved on and things have changed, but it seems to me that often we act like a man or a woman with a hammer, and the hammer is design or technology or manufacturing tools, and that person sees everything as being a nail, so something to be solved with design, technology, tools, and so on. And I want to know what the underlying philosophy informing this is, because it seems rather soulless in a way. And you talk about, I think you use the word democratic control. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, the Labour Party came up with, in the 1910s, and it was an inspiring thing. But, what is the bigger political philosophy from which these sort of tools that you advocate flow?
I'll give you a minute to think about that.
Okay.
Sorry, who was the other person I pointed to? Huh? Sorry,
I really liked the concept of the Alpha City,
Because obviously the city itself creates parameters of control and playfulness and events. And I was just thinking in terms of obviously master planning, you know, we've got designers do like clean cut renders, you know, and doesn't really follow suit to, you know, the output expectation that will, you know, be experienced by people, because obviously the atmosphere will change, you know, climate change, the world's, you know, being more densely populated in urban fabrics. And this idea of this meta-stability, you know, got me curious and thinking, how could we achieve that? Is it tied in with sustainability, or is it about more or less healing the urban fabric?
Whoa. Well, let me say first that I don't believe in sustainability, because I don't think that anything that we do now is in fact sustainable. And I would argue that the arisal of the rhetoric around resilience is in fact a tacit acknowledgement of that, that nothing is in fact sustainable. And so therefore we better be thinking about how to triage and how to make things stand back up again. Of course, that has implications for the people who are asked to shoulder the burden of that resilience. It's always, you know, the people who have shouldered the burden of everything since day one. It's always the poor. It's always the people who have no access to power or resources that are essentially asked to pay the costs of resilience. What is the other stable state of the system? Well, hopefully there are multiple stable states in the metastable system that we're in. Hopefully there are multiple different ways of organizing society that, you know, each one of which is a product of its moment, of the capacities that are available to us. And I'm not a techno-determinist by any stretch of the imagination. I don't believe that technologies determine the shape of things, but I do think that technologies have affordances and constraints. I do think that technologies present us with, you know, things. When we adopt a technology, that particular technology will make it easier to do some things and harder to do others. So it's you know, very easy to sit in a chair, and you can also stand on a chair, but it is really hard to do cardiopulmonary resuscitation with a chair, right? So everything that we use has a set of affordances and constraints. I think that all too often we don't inquire particularly deeply of the affordances and the constraints of the things that we embrace. And I think also that there is a sort of an existential issue that you can't necessarily know beforehand what becomes easier in the presence of a certain thing than another. This is why regulation rather than specification, I think, is probably a healthier and a wiser way of going about doing things. But I do believe that the technologies that are now available to us and that are sort of ubiquitous in the air and that are increasingly robust, increasingly distributed, and available at extremely low cost, to the point that something like 30% of the adults on the planet have a smartphone or equivalent in their pocket, and that, you know, wireless access is sufficiently robust that you can get the network from most places at most times in sufficient bandwidth to most of the things you might want to do. That does enable patterns of association, certain distinct patterns of association and collective and collaborative action that were much harder to do before. I mean, when you think about a small town in Ohio in the United States where some football players on the high school football team are accused of raping a woman, and all of the members of the police force and all of the members of local government are related to the coach of that football team, and that young woman isn't able to get even a hearing on her claims, let alone justice. And when you think that within maybe 36 hours of that happening, a global effort has assembled itself and begun to look at the interconnections of power in that community, and these are people around the world coming together to prize apart what's going on, to open up access to the actual documentation of the events that occurred, to hold the people involved responsible, and to ensure that they pay some cost for their actions, that is something that technology affords, something that our networked capacities let us do relatively easily that would have been very, very difficult to do in the age of landline telephones or telegraphs or the printed word. Is that, you know, an ideal for living? It's not my ideal for living. It's Anonymous. I mean, the group that did that was Anonymous. And Anonymous is, you know, not merely a two, but a multiple-edged sword. It is, you know, a terrible, terrible thing to attract the attention of Anonymous. Believe me, you do not want that. But it does offer some hope of at least balance in a world where the asymmetries that exist are so, you know, vertiginously oriented against people without power, poor people, people of color, queer people, differently abled people, elderly people, outsiders. If you don't belong, then you don't have access to the levers of power. And now, in some way, there's some recourse to a mechanism that might begin to balance that a little bit. I find that, at the very least, a provocative possibility and something to be explored, and that affordance to be opened up, and the negative aspects of it, if possible, to be buffered, because I like the idea that a small town high school football coach and his cousin, the police chief, and, you know, all of the kids that they're relying upon to play to glory on their field don't get to call the shots when there's been a violation of justice like that. I like that. And maybe those are my politics. I don't know. You know, I would say that I'm an anarchist, but I don't think that that's a particularly useful term anymore. I do believe, and I'm sorry if you find these to be canned ideas, but I think these are accurate and concise ways of describing what I've seen. I do believe in horizontal, leaderless, networked organizations that are assembled in something close to real time for a given purpose and which fulfill that purpose for as long as they're able to, and then possibly disassemble to assemble elsewhere on different terrains for different purposes. It's, you know, is that a coherent political philosophy? I can't tell you. I don't know. Well, I think I believe in this sort of infrastructure. I mean, you can look at Switzerland, right? And you can say that's a confederation. It's a federation of autonomous local collectives, and it's extraordinarily conservative. You know, do I think that I'd want to live in Switzerland? No. But I actually think that, you know, if you could seek to understand the structure, the structuration of political affect in Switzerland and learn from it, you know, there's something there. It's not necessarily an outcome, given the particular people involved and their particular purposes, that I'd want to endorse. I don't want to live there. I don't want to be like that. But I do think that there are certain major challenges that they don't confront as a result of their choosing to organize themselves that way that I have to find in my life, where I live here or in the United States, I have to find some other set of solutions to. I have burdens upon me that that infrastructure and that architecture has removed from their shoulders, which allows them to do other things. That's probably as coherent a statement of political program as I'll ever be able to articulate for you. I'm sorry.
That's good enough for me, actually. I mean, it's 8 o'clock, so I'm terribly sorry that I haven't had time to take all the questions. Are you burning to make a final comment, or will I draw it to a close? And
no, I think Adam's denunciation of Switzerland was obviously very
Well, thank you all very, very much for coming. I think it's been incredibly kind of stimulating vision of future possibilities, and I'd like you just to finish by thanking the speakers again.